On February 4th, a new coalition government took office in Austria. It includes the nation's extreme-right Freedom Party, which is closely associated with the controversial Austrian politician Jörg Haider. In a rare example of widespread and unified protest against such internal matters, the European Union took immediate steps to sanction and isolate Austria, a member nation. The United States quickly followed suit. Haider has since resigned as official head of the Freedom Party, but the party remains in office. As our guest today will explain, the controversy has deep historical roots. He is Anson Robinbach, professor of history and director of the program in European Cultural Studies at Princeton University. Welcome, Professor Robinbach.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Let me ask you to first briefly summarize for us, if you will, what's happened in Austria to cause such an international commotion.
Well, as you mentioned, after 50 relatively, more than 50 relatively peaceable years in Austria, a far-right extremist party has been included, I should be very precise about this, has been included in a coalition government, not for the first time actually in Austrian history, but in an important way for the first time since the end of World War II.
When you say they're included, are they included in a majority capacity or minority?
No, they're a minority. They're a minority in a coalition government with the Majority People's Party, party under the leadership of a man named Wolfgang Schüssel.
Okay. So why is the European Union so upset with all of this?
Well, I think the European Union's reaction, very profound and overwhelmingly consensual reaction, I might add, was not because this government was in any way undemocratically elected. On the contrary, precisely because it was democratically elected, it posed a very serious danger for Europe. The protest of the European Union was a moral protest against the inclusion of a far-right party in a center-far-right coalition. This is really an anomaly in Europe. Since 1945, European political leaders, especially conservatives, have had a virtual taboo on such coalitions. Conservatives barred entry into legitimate politics of the extreme right because of the memory of the interwar period, when many authoritarian and fascist parties came to power legally by being included in precisely such center-far-right coalitions, the most famous one being the coalition of Hitler and the Catholic Party of von Papen in 1933, which brought Hitler to power in Germany.
Before I take you back in history, let me just follow up on that a bit. Why do you think they violated that taboo to which you just referred?
Why did the Austrians violate that taboo?
Right.
Well, very simply because the politics of post-war Austria, which really included 50 years of a virtual coalition government and more than 30 years of government by a majority Social Democratic Party, had literally become bankrupt. The parties could not form, the two major parties, the People's Party could not, and the Socialist Party could not form a coalition. In fact, the other reason is that Haider, and I think this is another reason for the European Union's extreme reaction, is that Haider's party has an unprecedented vote and is one of the most successful, is the most successful far-right party in Europe.
Okay.
Haider received, in the October elections, the Freedom Party received 27% of the vote, whereas most far-right parties in Europe get about, at the most, 15% of the vote and generally average around 5% of the vote and in most cases less.
Is there a fear of spillover here or a momentum for the right?
I think there is a fear that that Haider will become a model for other far-right parties to change their political strategy to become more acceptable, to become more modern, as Haider is, and to be seductive enough to conservative parties to be included in such coalitions. Chancellor Schroeder in Germany referred to the Haiderization of Europe, and I think that sums up the threat that the European Union was reacting to.
Okay, I may want to return to that, but in your op-ed you wrote recently for the LA Times, you suggested that one answer for all of this lies in Austria's sort of Nazi years, taking us back really to the end of World War I. Explain that for us, if you will.
Well, I think that's very much the case. I think that a man like Haider, and I should add, I'd just like to add that Haider is not, as he's often been described, a neo-fascist or a neo-Nazi. It would be much too simple to describe him in this way. In many respects, he's a free market politician who's also against the European Union. That's a paradox, and he's full of paradoxes. He's for the welfare state, but he's against what his party has called the over-foreignization of Austria. In other words, the welfare state is for Austrians, not for foreigners. And he has made on occasion in the past pro-Nazi statements, but he's issued as many or more mea culpas for those statements. So he's very difficult to pin down, a very slippery character.
Very good point.
And I think that also is part of his appeal and his success.
Okay.
But to come back to your question about the Nazi years, I think Austria has had a very odd post-war history. In many ways, unlike Germany, it has not had to face its Nazi past. In fact, after 1945, Austria was welcomed into the community of European nations as the first country to be occupied by the Nazis. That was, in fact, the declaration of the Allies issued in Moscow in 1943, to the effect that Austria was the first victim of Nazi aggression. And that, of course, created what could, I think, reasonably called the myth of post-war Austria, that Austrians had a national consciousness before 1938, that most Austrians were anti-Nazi, that most Austrians suffered under the Nazis. None of that, of course, is true. The Anschluss with Germany in March 1938 was welcome. There was tremendous pro-Hitler sentiment in Austria. 1 million people greeted Hitler's first speech on the Heldenplatz in Vienna. Austria profited from Nazification. It profited from the Aryanization of Jewish property. Many Austrians personally profited from that. There was a great deal of social mobility for Austrians under the Nazis. And, of course, Nazified Austria was deeply committed in the crimes of the Nazis. After the war, all of that was forgotten. And it was forgotten in part for good reasons. Austria in the First Republic, that is from 1918 to 1938, this is pre-Nazi Austria, was a very violent and contentious place. The political parties, the Christian Social Party, which was in many ways the forerunner of today's People's Party, and the Socialist Party, were armed camps. They had private armies, each of which was larger than the Austrian National Army. There were almost daily street battles. The Republic was a place of a kind of permanent civil war, latent civil war, that erupted in a real civil war in February 1934. The socialists were banned. Many of them went into exile. And then from 1934 to 1938, the Nazi Party and the Christian Social Party also competed for control of Austria. The Austrian dictator Engelbert Dollfuss, who was a Christian social dictator, he came from a small party actually, but he was an Austrian fascist, as he's often referred to, was assassinated by the Nazis, who tried to take power in a coup d'etat in July 1934. Interestingly enough, by the way, just a parenthesis, Jörg Haider's father was one of the participants in that putsch attempt. He was a part of a military force that was poised to take over Austria after the success of the assassination attempt. Of course, that failed, and he was sent into exile. But this this history goes a long way, I think, towards explaining Jörg Haider's sentimental feelings about some of these former Nazis in Austria.
So, 2 points follow up on that. You're suggesting, and I think this might be news to some, then that the far right was more of a threat during the 30s than was the communist left.
Oh, I think that's very true in Austria. I think that the problem with Austrian politics is that it's very complicated and that there were two far rights. There was a Christian social far right, and there was a Nazi far right, and they were at loggerheads with each other. These parties were literally competing for control of Austria. So in many ways, the Nazification of Austria in 1938 solved the problem of the internal civil war, the multi-party civil war that existed from 1918 to 1945. I should also add that after World War I, most Austrians did not feel like they belonged to a country called Austria. The general feeling was that the country, the Austria, did not have the capacity to survive. Most Austrians, German-speaking Austrians, felt that they belonged to Germany. And in fact, all of the parties, not just the parties of the right, but the parties of the left and the parties of the center as well, favored an Anschluss, an annexation, by Germany in 1918. This was prevented and precluded by the post-war diplomatic settlements, which obviously did not want to strengthen Germany by adding Austrian territory to Germany. The purpose of the Versailles Agreement, as is well known, and the other agreements, was to weaken Germany. So Austria was denied the privilege of annexation. Many Austrians felt that this was a very dark period in Austrian history. In any case, there was no real national consciousness in Austria before World War II. It was only after World War II that Austrians had to, in effect, invent a tradition of national consciousness and national identity. And that is another reason that the past was swept under the rug. After 1945, Austria was occupied by all four powers. In fact, it was occupied by the Russians, the Americans, the French, and the British until 1955. The famous film The Third Man really gives you a feeling for how that occupation worked. And Austrians wanted to make sure that they appeared to be a nationally oriented, peaceful, democratic people so that they could, in effect, win their independence, which they did in 1955, a very anomalous situation in the history of Europe, I might add. They were the only country in Europe from which the Soviets withdrew in 1955 as a gesture of Khrushchev's towards the West, and Austria became independent in the State Treaty of 1955. So there were many reasons to sweep the past under the rug, to make sure that the enmity between the old armed parties didn't flare up again, that Austrians appeared to be democratic and capable of cooperation, and they in fact were. The new republic, the Second Republic that came about after 1955, was in effect a very stable government. In fact, it was an excessively stable government.
Okay. Let me just follow up then so you can tie this correctly in. We only have a couple minutes left. You said in your op-ed that the greatest appeal that Haider seems to have had is to voters under 30. Now, how do they play into this sort of romantic?
Well, I think that's this is very much consistent with what I've said up to now. The new political system that emerged in Austria after 1955 was a system of a division of power between the two major parties. What that meant, in effect, was that the two parties controlled every political appointment, every civil service appointment, and most municipal appointments. To be a fireman or a sanitation worker or a teacher or even a college professor, you had to belong to one of the parties. And these parties apportioned and distributed those jobs. It was the parties, the People's Party and the Socialist Party, had a lock grip on Austrian society. And young people today, confronted with that system, feel that it's first of all, in many ways, not a terribly democratic system, that it doesn't, that it's certainly not a meritocratic system, and it's certainly not a system with a lot of freedom. So young people see Haider's party in many ways as the breaking up of the monopoly of power held by the two major parties, the People's Party and the Socialist Party, since the end of World War II.
Okay, very briefly, Austrians see this as an internal matter, yet the EU is bringing pressure upon them. I know you're an historian, not a soothsayer, but what's going to happen, do you think?
Well, it's very interesting. I think that first of all, I should say that most Austrians, Haider gets 27% of the vote, but 70% of Austrians have said in polls that they did not favor a government with the Freedom Party. The demonstrations over the last weekend in Vienna, which mobilized some 300,000 people against the government, show that many, many people are willing to take to the streets against this new constellation in Austrian politics. My feeling is that this is a party, that this is a government, I should say, this is a government that is very much under pressure, a government that is under the watchful eye not only of Austrians but of Europe. Now, of course, there are many Austrians, I suppose, and the polls show this, who feel that the EU has overreacted, that Austria is becoming isolated, and that has, in some areas, enhanced Haider's popularity. My general feeling is that this government will not last long and that there will be new elections. And that, I think, is a very, it's very difficult to say what will happen, but certainly if the Freedom Party becomes the majority party in Austria, that that would be a very, very pessimistic outcome for the situation. My hope is that the Green Party, which seems to be gaining support since the government was formed, and the Socialist Party will be able to form a coalition and put both the People's Party and the Freedom Party out of office. But I think that will take time. This is a process that will take many months, if not years.
All right. Well, we'll all be keeping an eye on it and maybe invite you back sometime to either take credit for the correct prediction or explain why you were wrong. Thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Anson Robbenbach, Professor of History and Director of the Program in European Cultural Studies at Princeton University. And you are listening to Talking History.